talking with Groot Reber at the University of Washington on 25th October, 75. Now, I was asking you about the article you sent to Astrophysical Journal in 1940, and what was the reception that you got?
Well, the reception was one of doubt, and I was invited to come up there and give him a colloquium on the subject.
I see.
And which I did. As a matter of fact, I'd been up there a number of times beforehand, because before undertaking the experiments, I canvassed around to see what else was being done. And I'd been told by Jansky that they weren't going to do anything more. I contacted Shapley at Harvard. They were very aware of Jansky's work, but they weren't going to do anything. I had talked to Struve at least once, and perhaps several times, with the idea of seeing if he could help raise some money to do these things, and if they were going to do anything. And he said that the effect that they weren't going to do anything, and the reason they weren't was that they had their hands full with their own business, and that they deemed this to be outside their sphere of competence.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as raising money was concerned, he didn't have enough money for his own purposes.
Right.
In other words, they were aware of it, but they weren't going to do anything. So here was a situation where a scientific opportunity was open and nobody was going to do anything.
Now, what is your opinion as to, was it just a matter that they felt that it wasn't that important and besides they didn't know anything about it? Or,
well,
is it fair to say they were short-sighted, or was it?
No, I wouldn't say they were short-sighted. You have to remember, in that day, even a photoelectric cell in a DC amplifier was a mysterious black box.
Yeah.
You know, when it came to vacuum tubes and amplifiers and tuned circuits and all the rest of it,
right,
they just didn't have any comprehension of these matters.
Right.
And they didn't build radio sets. They weren't even radio amateurs.
Right.
If they needed a radio, they went out the store and bought one.
Right.
And consequently, well, from their point of view, it would be foolish to embark on anything like this. The chances of them going wrong would be about 100 to 1.
But mightn't they not have they could hire a couple of radio engineers, and if they thought that the astronomical results would be exciting enough, interesting enough.
I don't know what their thoughts on that were. The thing that dismayed them was the lack of resolution.
Hmm.
The only data available was Jansky's that had a resolution of about 30 degrees.
Right, right.
In other words, you could tell the difference between the Milky Way and not the Milky Way, and that was about all. Well, in their eyes, anything was as crude as that. Didn't have much astronomical merit.
Right, how were they ever going to tie it in with their optical work?
And they had no way of knowing how it could be improved. They weren't in 10 engineers.
Right, right.
And they were going to get in way over their ears if they weren't careful.
Right.
So, I think this was characteristic of all the optical people. This branch of physics related to electromagnetic waves, at least of this nature, it just wasn't part of their repertoire.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And that's the reason Harvard didn't do anything and the others didn't do anything.
So did you contact anyone else besides Shapley and Struve to try to convince them?
Well,
any other
I can't remember at this late date. I do remember those two, because mm-hmm. Harvard was considered one of the leading observatories and Yerkes was close by, and I knew the people at Yerkes.
And you probably were aware of the Whipple and Greenstein paper.
Aware of?
The Whipple and Greenstein paper in 1937, where they tried to interpret
the Academy.
Right.
Yes, I was aware of that.
So,
but
to a small extent, Harvard did try to do it theoretically, anyway.
Yes, but if I remember, I've forgotten the details of that paper. But if I remember, all it did was prove that the phenomena they proposed wouldn't work.
Right, dust grains, mainly. Right.
What was the phenomena they proposed?
Just the thermal radiation of dust.
Oh.
And they showed that the dust could not be any more than
a few
degrees, and
yeah,
and yet the other was millions of degrees.
So it wouldn't possibly work.
Yeah.
And then I came forward with this free transitions.
Right. Okay. But let me. Oh, gee, there's so many things to ask you. You came. Okay. How did you come up with the free idea? Where did that come from?
Really, at this day, I don't know. But free transitions were part of a course. I took it to the University of Chicago. I took some astronomy courses there, and mathematics and physics and a mm-hmm. variety of things. And in some manner, free transitions were brought up to demonstrate some optical phenomenon. I just see what that optical phenomenon was. Maybe it had to do with the corona of the sun. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, it came up, and it was demonstrated that this phenomenon, whatever it was, could be explained in terms of free-free transitions.
Right.
Some high kinetic energies. And I thought to myself, you know, this might be worthwhile investigating. So I took these same formulas and put in lower frequencies and some suitable temperatures. And lo and behold, it looked as though the numbers that came out might, at least
feasible, yeah.
vaguely, within an order of magnitude, fit Jaskie's results. Which Whipple and Greenstein didn't come within several orders of magnitude.
Right, right. Do you remember which course this was? As to who taught it and so forth? I'd be interested.
I think it was one I took with P.C. Canass.
With him?
With him, yeah. Well, he was the instructor.
Oh, he was the instructor, I see.
Yeah, he was the instructor.
That's interesting.
There. I took quite a few courses there. I've forgotten the details of them.
As a graduate student, more or less?
Yeah.
I see.
And all courses in infinite series and a whole lot of that kind of stuff, and geometric optics, and see, it wouldn't be in any of those. Probably in Canass' course.
Hmm. And what was the topic of the course?
Yeah.
What was the topic?
I don't know.
Okay.
No, but probably some kind of astrophysics.
Yeah.
Right? Just what kind of astrophysics, I don't know.
Maybe stellar atmospheres or
could
something.
Could be. Anyhow, it was in this course in astrophysics that this business of free-free transitions was brought forward to explain some optical phenomena. I thought to myself, now here's a new scheme. This might be worth investigating from a Hertzian wave point of view.
Right.
And I put in some numbers, and it looked pretty good. And that's that.
Right, so you published it first in the Proceedings of the IRE.
That's right.
But now, what was your motivation to try to put it into APJ?
Well, that was a pretty crude dissertation. And I think, see, this is all pretty far back, but I think the reason it went to the Institution of Radio Engineers was that the original paper that finally appeared in Astrophysical Journal a few months later, if you recall, mainly related to the results.
Right.
Okay? And Struve stuck to his guns that they were astronomers and not engineers. And that he felt that anything that appeared in the Astrophysical Journal should be primarily related to astrophysics and not engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened was, at this late date, that the part that I wanted to put in related to the equipment was edited out by Struve, mm-hmm. and so I sent it to the Institution of Radio Engineers. Now that's as near as I can remember.
Right. Well, it seems to me that the APJ paper is almost exactly the same as the IRE paper, except for the elimination of the whole free-free interpretation.
Yes.
Which then is in Henier and Keenan's,
yes.
Keenan's paper afterwards.
Yes.
Not even the IRE paper has much on the equipment. In the 1940, the 1942 one,
yes.
Goes into a lot of detail.
That's right.
Yes. So, but are you saying that your original manuscript for the APJ did have much more on equipment?
I think it did.
I see.
I think it had pictures of that early equipment, if you remember, some appeared and some datas.
Right,
know,
right.
That, I'm pretty sure, was all sent to Struve.
I see. And now, what about your theoretical work? So you wanted to cut out the description of the engineering side. And how did it work as far as the theory goes? What was his reaction to all this?
Well, the reaction seemed to be that at least as far as people, the Yerkes were concerned, there was a wide spectrum. Canan was, well, had an open mind, and he'd been the first ones, I say, to come down and take a look and satisfy himself that it wasn't an out-and-out hoax.
Right.
Then this ranged through doubt to, well, innocuous disbelief.
Right.
To Kuiper, who was at the other end of the scale, and I remember distinctly him telling me that he thought that I was just crudely in error, that all I was getting was noises out of arc lights. In other words, he was an absolute doubter, but he hadn't been there yet
mm-hmm.
to see this stuff. And I don't think he was very cognizant well, he must have read, or at least known about, but I don't think he'd taken the bother to read in any intelligent manner Jansky's results. Mm-hmm. Struve had, I'm pretty sure.
Right.
And people like Chandrasekhar sort of stood by the sidelines and looked to see what went on.
Watched the whole show. Signed with the victor after it's all over.
Right.
But,
so yeah. It wasn't a situation where there was a tight group that had any particular ideas on this matter. There was a spectrum of opinion.
Right, right. And did you discuss these results before you sent the paper up or before your colloquium? Or was it sort of that you, all of a sudden this all came upon them and they had to...
No. I must have discussed it individually with several of these people beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have given me the invitation to come and give them a colloquium.
Right. And you gave the colloquium just before you submitted the paper, more or less?
Oh, a year or so.
A year or so. So it was more preliminary, I guess.
Yeah, it was certainly within a few months of the time I got some initial results.
I see.
See, I think I got those initial results in the spring of 38, wasn't it?
Or 39.
Well, 39, something like that.
It says in your paper, anyway, yeah.
Well, it was within a few months of that.
I see. What was the reaction at the cloakroom itself? You feel like you were in a den of lions, or...?
Can't remember. There were quite a number of graduate students there, including this Olin Egan.
Oh, yeah.
Who's now in charge of Mount Stromlo.
Right.
And he remembers that cloakroom very well. In fact, listening to him, he remembers it better than I do. there were quite a few people there, maybe 30, maybe more.
Yeah.
Because most all the staff was there.
Right.
And a considerable number of graduate students. This was at York East. I don't remember that there was anybody from the university came. There were quite a number of questions, but in retrospect, I don't remember that they could be called intelligent questions. I think the background of the audience, as the students and the professors, wasn't suitable. They didn't know enough to ask an intelligent question.
Right.
And consequently, there wasn't a great discussion about it.
But they weren't...
They weren't against it.
Yeah, right. I mean, they weren't trying to knock you down either.
No, not at all.
It was just sort of outside, like you say, of their sphere of knowledge.
Yeah, see.
But now, is it true that after you submitted this paper to Struve, that he specifically at that time sent someone down to check you out, so to speak? This is the apocryphal story, and I want to find out if it's apocryphal or true, I guess.
Struve himself didn't come. Canaan was down there at least once, on his own. Then, he came, and I remember this time Kuiper came with Canaan. Kuiper's attitude was very different. It must have been within a year. He changed his mind. There were some others with him, who I don't remember. There may have been, I think, now that you speak about it, there probably were a couple of graduate students came along, because it was a party of a half a dozen.
I see.
I remember Canaan and Kuiper. Whether Chandrasekhar ever came or not, I don't know. I can't remember. He may have.
And did you have the definite impression that this was a proving for you, that whether or not your paper got published would depend on...
No, I don't think so. I think that was determined before that. I think Struve, see, you're asking me questions about which I really don't have any great knowledge. That is, I wasn't a member of the staff of York East or on the editorial board or anything.
Right.
But the impression I got was that the Astrophysical Journal as of that day was pretty much solely edited by Alice Struve.
Mm-hmm.
And what he decided went in and what he decided went out.
Right.
It wasn't by any referee system or anything like that. So. No, this is just my impression.
Right, right.
So, after Canaan had been there and we discussed these things, then this second delegation came. About half a dozen, as I say. And I think there were some other visits. Oh, I know there were, because not immediately, but in succeeding years.
Yeah.
Oh, I got quite a few delegations.
Right.
Come.
Well, Jesse Greenstein's told me he came.
Oh, yeah, he maybe was on that second group, probably. Let's just mention it. Because I know he was there. Just when, I don't remember anymore.
And what did you do in these visits? Did you move the dish around for them and show them how the
results
vary?
Sort of thing? I showed them some of the results, And of course, they always came in the daytime when the automobiling issue was very severe, so you couldn't show them anything very interesting as far as the results were concerned being taken.
Yeah.
Whether or not that particular group or a succeeding group encountered, I don't know, but there were some groups, or some individuals anyhow, who I urged to come an hour before noon and watch the equipment as the sun transited. And this was quite impressive.
This was after you detected the sun, of course.
Oh, yeah. This
43,
was
1943. Yeah.
Because that's about all you could show them in the daytime.
Right.
And then still later, about 1945, when solar activity rose, there wasn't anybody from the observatory, but there was somebody else. In fact, three other people. One of them, including Ken Norton of the Bureau of Standards, and two others, there were three, showed up by prearrangement on a particular day, early, that is maybe 10:30 in the morning, because I wanted to show them what happened when the sun went by. This was at 480 megacycles by this time. This is in 1946, maybe. And it dumbfounded me, too. But what happened was that the sun was very active that day, far beyond anything I had ever encountered. And way before the sun was supposed to transit, there were a lot of small blips on the record. And you could listen to the whooshing noises, see? And they disappeared after about maybe 5 minutes. And then they came in again, only stronger. And they rose and fell, and then they disappeared. The second time, some of them went nearly to the top of the scale. And the third time, when the sun should transit, there were a few of these blips, and then the pin went right up hard with the pin and stayed up there for about 15 minutes. And then it came down again.
Amazing.
And then it went through the same cycle in reverse.
So these were side lobes of the antenna.
Side
lobes! Did you know you had all these side lobes out
no.
there? This is the first indication.
You wouldn't find the side lobes in any normal conditions, but these things are about 40 or 50 dB up.
Right.
And I remember these fellows saying, look, the thing's off scale. And he said, yeah, it's off scale. And he said, well, turn the gain down. You can't turn the gain down that much. It'll only turn down maybe 8 or 10 dB, and that's not near enough. Well, they said, must be some way of turning the gain down. I remember somebody said, how do you know it's coming from the sun? This may be something else. So then we went out and we unloosened the machine and turned away from the sun. It all went away.
Right.
We turned back in the sun, it all came back.
Right.
And that really convinced me.
No doubt about it.
It was tremendous. It was beyond anything I've seen.
Just to go back to the one more question about the 1940 paper.
Yeah.
Was it a matter that Struve sort of said to you, well, here's how much of your paper we'll publish, and that you were sort of happy just to get that published? And
that's, I think, what it
right.
was. Sure.
And did you know that the Henye and Keenan were going to essentially
yeah,
work?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they gave you credit for the idea, but then they went ahead and worked it out in much
yeah,
more
Yeah, as a matter
detail.
Of fact, I think, vaguely now, Struve sort of didn't issue an ultimatum, but he stated that these astronomical matters should be dealt with by astronomers, and that he sort of instructed Kanan to work this thing up to write up a paper which would be a supplement to mine.
Right. That's
what I think it was fair.
Yeah, it's a good compromise, right?
Sure.
That's what Kanan told me, yeah. That was his impression. Once again, he wasn't exactly sure.
In other words, they would work it up properly.
Yeah. Okay, well, if we can, I'd like to go back now to right back to the beginning, so to speak, and ask you a little bit about your background, if you don't mind, about
sure.
where you grew up and so forth.
I grew up there in childhood, that is in Wheaton, Illinois.
Oh, I see. That's your hometown, actually.
Oh, yeah. I was just born in Chicago, but as soon as I was a few days old, they put me out there to the maternal home. Interesting thing in relation to that. Most babies make their presence known long before they're born. And so there's a lot of discussion about what the newcomer is going to be, and there's a whole variety of names associated with this newcomer
right.
to be slapped on him as soon as he arrives. Right.
Right.
Well, my parents were sort of delinquent in that manner. And I guess I was the chief feature of the action, but in any case, I don't remember these things at that stage. However, my birth certificate testifies simply that a male child has been born to so-and-so, one baby Reber. That's all it says. Apparently, they had to issue this birth certificate within 48 hours.
They couldn't make up their mind on the name.
See, and by that time, they haven't been able to make up their mind. So that's what's on the birth certificate.
What is the name Grode, by the way? It's obviously not a common name.
It's a custom among Central European people to give the child the mother's maiden name as a middle name.
Yeah.
Okay. And then to give him some ordinary handle for a first name. And so I should have gotten a name like Henry or William or Frederick or something like that. And then we say William Grote Reber. They didn't do that. They just gave me, my mother was a Miss Harriet Grote. So they called me Grote Reber.
It's your mother's maiden name, isn't it?
Well, this has been sort of a nuisance throughout life because I should be called Bill or Hank or something.
Oh, I don't know. I get tired of those names.
Anyhow, they were delinquent in that. And in that day, it didn't make much difference because birth certificates were just pieces of paper that nobody paid much any attention to. But as time went on and we got more regimented, birth certificates became more important. Very fortunately, about 1940, before my mother died, my father died rather earlier, I had her write a document signed by a notary public testifying that this baby Reber on birth certificate so-and-so was in fact the same individual as one Grote Reber. Now, there's been considerable assistance because if I've had to produce a birth certificate, and all that's got on there in the baby river is the end of the old baby running around the loops.
Right.
Anyhow, those two are stapled together now.
So, was all of your primary and secondary schooling in Wheaton also?
Matter of fact, primary school was within about two blocks of where we lived. Secondary schooling was three-quarter of a mile away.
And when did you first start getting involved with radio?
Oh, when I was in high school. I was one of these radio amateur fellows, and
this is about what time now?
We lived in a fairly free and easy manner, but far from opulent. This was sort of an open place, and there was a good-sized garage out back, and there was a large yard. We had half an acre to fool around in, and we had some trees. Parent did some gardening, and we had a few animals like cats and dogs, things like that. And there were some rather large trees around we used to climb, and they were suitable for hanging aerial wires on, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
What time is this now? What year is this, roughly?
Well, I maybe was a junior in high school about the time I got my first radio amateur license.
But what year would that be? 1920?
Oh boy, 1928 maybe?
Late 20s.
Yeah, that'd be about right. See, I was born 1911, 1928, I'd be 17.
Right.
That'd be about a junior in high school,
right?
Yeah, I think so. That'd be about it.
Hey, may I ask what profession your father was?
Yes, he was canned goods manufacturer.
I see.
He was a senior partner in a firm of Reber Preserving Company. And it was just a small operation. They sold most of their products in Chicago. And the factory was a place called Eola, E-O-L-A, about maybe 15 miles from Wheaton. He inherited from my grandfather. I had an aunt once who was sort of a social climber, and she thought that probably would enhance her social position if she could become a member of the DAR. And so she hired one of these chronology people to search out her ancestry. And I'm pretty sure this is right. Anyhow, it was through her that it was found out that part of the Rebers we descended from were a couple of Reber brothers who came into Pennsylvania from Strasburg in, I think, 1708.
I see.
And they were just farmers and lived in Pennsylvania, and I think in Bucks County or somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, then during Civil War, my grandfather was on fought the side of the North, but he wasn't exactly a military man, and so he got himself captured. And that day they exchanged prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory being was that if you were exchanged, you couldn't do any more fighting. You could support him in some non-military capacity. So effectively, after he got himself traded off, then he was out of the war.
I see.
And see, all this is related to me very much many years later. Anyhow, he decided he wanted to go where he thought was more opportunity. I don't know what his background was. I guess nothing in particular. And at least I never was told that he had any training in anything. And he came out to Chicago and he set up on his own manufacturing preserves. That is,
I see.
Jam and jelly, that kind of thing. And he prospered because he was a very industrious individual, mm-hmm. I gather. And they had the Reba Preserving Works. And he had several sons and he named them. It's, I guess, customary in that day, after people he thought were important people. And one of them, who died before my time, was an Irving Reaver, apparently named after the name.
Washington Irving?
That's right, see? Although I gather my uncle, who I never knew, had no literary capability whatsoever.
Right. It was an attempt, anyway.
He helped run the can that the preserve works. Then another uncle who died not so long ago was named after the inventor of the steam engine, James Watt.
James Watt Reaver. What was your father's name?
Well, he was named after a Pennsylvania politician who my grandfather thought was quite a fellow named Schuyler Colfax. Who I gather from more recent comments, it was a somewhat dubious politician. Right. In any case, that's the way it was.
But now you did not inherit the canning works, I presume.
Well,
you decided you wanted to.
It was still going some years ago, but I had no interest in that. And it gradually passed into the hands of one of my cousins.
I see.
And the last that I know, he was running it.
So when you got out of high school, what did you decide that you wanted to do?
Well, it was by that time very evident that I wanted to do something in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of inclined electrically, so my parents had the wisdom and the foresight to send me to the engineering school in Chicago called the Armor Institute of Technology.
The which institute?
Armor Institute.
Armor. Uh-huh.
It later been amalgamated with something else and became what's now the Illinois Institute of Technology.
I see.
And that A is this A. We were for armor.
Oh, for armor. I see.
And it was a school where they, well, they taught engineering, you know, with calculus and all the rest of it, and they had dynamo labs and chemistry labs and this kind of thing. We got a pretty good inculcation in the actual doings of engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But they leaned over heavily on things which I think are skipped today pretty much, in that we had a lot of stuff which would be called trades. As we had
machine shops, or
oh yes, machine shop, pattern making,
right.
Forging.
Right.
A lot of that stuff, see. In fact, the first 2 years was heavily given to this trade stuff. I think in later years, the more intellectual ends of the school got control of it and pitched most of that out.
Yeah.
But it served me in good stead.
I guess it certainly did.
Now I can go out into shops and talk to these guys and not be given a lot of guff.
Right.
It's a lot of these tradesmen, you know, hand out.
So you went to the school for
4 years.
For 4 years.
Graduated Bachelor of Electrical Engineering.
In what year?
1933.
And then, what was your next step?
That was in the Depression.
Right.
And so I worked around at odd jobs of one kind or another. Finally, I got work in the radio industry in Chicago. Must have been about a year later.
Which company?
And I worked for two or three radio companies at different times in there until 1947.
Can you tell me which company is actually one?
Yes, I worked for the Belmont Radio Corporation, for the Stuart Water Corporation, and one, what was that other one?
What was the
Ford,
first one?
Something like
said.
That.
What was the first company you said?
A Belmont Radio Corporation.
Belmont. And then Stuart Water.
Stuart Water Corporation, and General Household Utilities. And I think they've all disappeared now, either by going bankrupt or by amalgamation.
And what was your, what sort of work did you do for these?
Well, I did various things. First, I worked in a test equipment department, you know, making and constructing test equipment for testing their product. And I didn't actually test the receivers, but I helped build and install the equipment used for testing the receivers. Because the actual testing of the receivers was considered a laboring job.
Mm-hmm. These receivers were home radio sets?
They're auto radio sets. That's about the only kind of radio sets were being manufactured at that time. Auto radio and home radio. Then, apparently I had a certain amount of ability. I got moved up into the engineering department. First is what they call a solder slinger. That is, you know, putting all the samples together. And then later is manipulating the test gear and designing the radio sets. And I worked in that capacity until 1947.
So towards the end, those last years, you were actually designing radio circuits and so forth for a wide variety of applications, I suppose.
In there, of course, were the war years. In that case, we didn't design anything, but we took the samples. See, these military agencies would come forward with some radar or IFF or direction finding gear or something that they had built in the government laboratory, and then they'd want us to manufacture it.
What does IFF stand for, by the way? What does IFF stand for? I saw this in a
computer. Identification, friend, or foe.
I see. I know what that is, right?
The scheme was that if you had aircraft out in the sky, you want to find out whether you're your aircraft or somebody else's aircraft, in other words, to identify them. And so there was a thing on the ground called an interrogator, and it sent out a pulse.
Right.
And then if it was your aircraft, it would send back the proper code. And then you could shoot at it.
Right. How many people manufactured these things?
That's right. Mm-hmm. So I assisted in the organization of these things and helping them get them made. And that was during the war year. And then after the war, we went back to making radio sets.
Well, now let me...